Rabbi, thank you very much. I am honored more by the by calling me a good friend than by being called a good speaker. But I appreciate both. And may the learning that we do this morning and the learning that comes from what we learn this morning provide Aliyas Neshama, provide merit for Devor Reisel Bas Mordechai. Yeah, after an introduction like that, I feel like I have to jump right into my first source, and you'll see why once you see the source. It's a letter that was written to the New York Times, as you see the date on it in source number one, by a fellow by the name of Donald Sheff, right after the passing of Isidore I. Rabi, who was a Nobel Prize winning physicist, Jewish. There are a couple of really great stories about him, actually, but we're going to focus on the one right here in the letter to the New York Times. Isidore I. Rabi, the Nobel laureate in physics, who died January 11th, was once asked, "Why did you become a scientist rather than a doctor or lawyer or businessman like the other immigrant kids in your neighborhood?" Just by way of background, his family came to the U.S. at the beginning of the 20th century, and it was 1898, 1899, from Poland. So his answer has served as an inspiration for me, the writer says, as an educator, as a credo for my son during his schooling, and should be framed on the walls of all the pedagogues, power brokers, and politicians who purport to run our society. Detect a little bit of cynicism in that purport, right? The question was posed to Dr. Rabi by his friend and mine, Arthur Sackler, himself a multi-talented genius who sadly also passed away recently. Dr. Rabi's answer, as reported by Dr. Sackler, was profound. "My mother made me a scientist without ever intending it. Every other Jewish mother in Brooklyn would ask her child after school, 'So, did you learn anything today?' But not my mother. She always asked me a different question. 'Izzy,' she would say, 'did you ask a good question today?' And that difference, asking good questions, made me become a scientist." So after that introduction about your mother, I felt like we have to jump right into that source. So now I'll work my way back. In general, Jews are known for asking questions. We're known for answering questions with questions. Abraham, our very first monotheist, questions God. You know the story. I don't know if I should even tell it so close to Pesach, but like it's matzah. Where, you know, you can't. At a certain point, you can't have it before Pesach. But I'll try anyway. You know the story of the Jewish knight, right? The fellow who was going to be knighted by Queen Elizabeth. No? Okay, great. The fresh audience. The elderly Jewish fellow is going to be knighted by Queen Elizabeth, and he's so excited that he's going to be knighted, and he says, "Well, what do I have to do?" And they say, "Well, you have to get dressed up, and you're going to come to the palace, and there's going to be a ceremony." "Oh, wonderful, I love doing that." And the only thing is that there's this line in Latin that you're going to have to say when you're in front of the queen. And he says, "Latin? What do I know from Latin?" "All right, look, I'll memorize the words. That's what I have to do. That's what I'm going to do." So he memorizes the word that he's going to have to say, and that's all he can think about before this ceremony. And he's taking the flight over to England so that he'll be there in plenty of time, and he's thinking all the way about these words in his head that he has to say. And he's in the hotel, and he's thinking the words that he has to say, and he's in the cab on the way to the palace, and he's thinking these words that he has to say, and he's waiting there for his turn, he's thinking the words that he has to say. But you know what happens when you get to a moment like that, right? Everything drops from your mind. And so suddenly he's there in front of the queen, and he freezes. And so he says the first foreign words that come to his mind, "Manishtana halayla zemi kol halaylot," to which the queen responds, "Why is this night different from all the other nights?" Jews are known, though, for asking questions, whether the manishtana or otherwise. Why do we value questions in Judaism? What is it about questions that so attracts us? Nope, not rhetorical. I don't ask rhetorical. I like putting people on the spot. What is it? Why is it that? And it's true. It's definitely a part of our approach. We may not be the only culture that does it, but we for sure excel at it. So what is that about? Yeah. desire for clarity. Okay, it's a high-minded ideal, right? We want clarity, we want truth, and therefore we're going to ask questions. Yes? Create a discussion. Okay, for the sake of
getting more out of it.
And no, there's also a function of curiosity. We want to learn something. Good. What else? Yes? Right. Sometimes, yes, curiosity with a purpose, okay, targeted towards learning something. Grab it, send it then. Okay. Getting to the substance of something, but it's not just in Torah. We ask questions everywhere, right? It is in, our questions are about, you know, anything and everything. Right. Yes.
When you ask a question, you don't only learn something. You may not, but you also get to know the person you're dealing with.
Right. Very good. Another angle on questions is connection, dialogue. It's a way to build a connection with the person to whom you're speaking. That's a second way. There's a third still. Yeah? There's an element. Well, there's an element of humility that certainly is expressed by asking a question. That's for sure. The Lo Abayi Shalom made, one who is shy is not going to be able to learn. You have to be able to have that feeling of, it's okay for me to say, I don't know, and to ask. That's absolutely true. But there's another type of question.
When you ask questions, you're more engaged in the discussion, what's going on.
Right? Asking questions means that you'll be more engaged. You're not simply listening and receiving. Very true. It's part of that learning process. There's also an element of skepticism. Right? That comes with a question. I don't simply accept, but I'm going to challenge. So that's another element of questions. I want to show the way that these various elements emerge in the Haggadah and why they're so important in the Haggadah. So for that, I need to turn our attention to the Seder itself. Questions in the Haggadah. Where do questions show up in the Haggadah? Right, well, Manishtana, right? You have the four questions, the four which are five, right? What are our Manishtana questions? Oh, come on. Well, yes, but what are the four things that we highlight? Matzah, Maror, dipping, and leaning. Right, and why did I call them five instead of four? No. Because these questions are very old, right? When do these questions begin? In our history? Right. These questions go all the way back to the time of the Beis Hamikdash, to temple times. You're talking about more than 2,000 years of Jews asking these questions, right? When you're a kid in like kindergarten or grade one and they teach you to ask these questions at the Seder, you think like they've taught you something new. No. Jews have been learning this in grade one for over 2,000 years. One day we'll get to grade two. These questions were asked in the Beis HaMikdash, except that instead of the question about leaning, you had a question about roasting. They asked, why does the Karban Pesach have to be roasted? Why is it that on this night we're eating roast? And it's actually a good vartara in its own right in terms of why we have roast. One classic answer is because roasting is considered to be the manner of royalty. When a person is poor, when a person is worried about where their next meal is coming from, and they have an animal that they're able to eat, they tend to boil it or do some form of cooking in which you can preserve all of the elements of it and eat everything. If you roast something over an open flame, the fat all drips out, you lose parts. That's not something that someone will do unless a person feels that they are royalty and they don't need to worry about anything. So that that's one reason that's given for why the Torah says explicitly to roast the Korban Pesach. So that was actually the fifth question, which has dropped out in the absence of a Korban Pesach today. But that's one set of questions. What about the other set of questions? Also early on in the Haggadah. Oh, come on. Sorry? Yeah, the four. I don't call them sons, the four children, because yes, it's true, the Torah says, Ben. However, the mitzvah indeed is to talk to our sons and daughters about it. We just don't have a neutral gender word. But if you take a look at source number two, you find where the Arba Banim come from, where these four kids come from. They come from times in the Torah in which a conversation between parent and child about leaving Egypt is described. So that the first one, I listed them here, as you see, in number two, not in the order in which they appear in the Chumash, but rather to parallel the order in the Haggadah. So the first set, the first question there is actually the question that we associate with the Chacham, with the wise one. Ki yishalcha bincham b'achar le'mor ma'edos v'achukim v'amishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu eschem. When your child asks you tomorrow, what are the testimonies, statutes, and laws which Hashem, your God, has commanded you? And then it continues, I brought it in the English, for some reason I didn't bring it in the Hebrew, I don't remember why. But you shall tell your child, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, Hashem took us out, and so on. That is your first, that's the Chacham, that's the wise one. The second question is the one that we associate with the Rasha. When your children will say to you, what is this service to you? And we say that's the question of the Rasha, of the wicked child. Why is it associated with wickedness? What is it about this question that grabs us? He removes himself by saying, lachem, for you. What else? Because after all, the Chacham did the same thing, right? The wise one also ended his question, eschem, God commanded you. What else is there in this question that we don't like?
Cynical.
What's cynical about it?
What is
all, well, the other ones are going to have wording like that, but he calls it avoda.
He calls it work.
Yeah, he calls it work. Which is something that's really, really important to keep in mind, because I think this is something that all of us slip into to one extent or another as the days leading up to Pesach are counted down and thinking of it as work and portraying it as work. And it's something that's very important because the way in which we describe it often affects the way that we feel about it, and certainly the way that our children and grandchildren feel about it. If they hear people krecht, if they hear people sigh and moan and groan when someone says 2 weeks to Pesach, that's what they absorb. That's what they're feeling. And then when they ask themselves years from now what they want to do for their own lives, you know, how likely are they to want to replicate that? So it's something that's worth thinking about. I wrote up recently, there's a study from the Cleveland Clinic that talks about pain anticipation and how when people anticipate pain, then they actually tend to exhibit pain, what they call pain behavior, more. They've done studies. Don't ask me how they do studies on people with the actual pain. I presume they didn't, just on the anticipation of pain. But they've done studies on this, and they find that people exhibit the behavior of somebody who is in pain to a much higher extent if they anticipate that pain is going to happen. So you have to be careful with that. Yes?
By the way, the concept of anticipation.
Yes. Right.
They also prove that the anticipation of something good that's going to come will have much higher joy than the actual fulfillment.
Very true. Thank you. So what we're saying here is that the Rasha, the wicked one, is the one who views it as work and says, what is this to you? And that's the second question. And here you see also the answer that's given to him. And then the third one, V'hayaki yishalcha v'incha le'mor, Machar Lemor, when your child asks you tomorrow, saying, Mazos, what is this? And that, of course, is the Tam. That's the one who is simple. He doesn't really understand. He says, what's this? And then the fourth one doesn't have a question. It simply says, you shall tell your child on that day, And that's the one who is the Eino Yodei Lishol. He doesn't know to ask questions. Those are our four. There's an awful lot we could say about the four. Of course, I'm not going to right now in the interest of getting to our main to our main message. But the reason I bring this is because it's important for us to realize as we read the Haggadah that the story of the four kids is not random. First of all, it's actually found in the Gemara. So again, this is something that goes back a couple of thousand years. And that it's anchored in psukim that are in the sentences that are in the Torah itself. But beyond these questions that are found explicitly in the Haggadah, there are things that we do at the Seder in order to inspire questions, in order to get the kids to ask more questions. What do we do at the Seder in order to inspire questions? Give out marshmallows. Excellent. I don't know how many people actually give out marshmallows.
We do.
You do, apparently.
Chocolate.
And chocolate. But that is actually a practice recorded in the Gemara. They didn't mention marshmallows because they didn't have kosher marshmallows at the time. But if you take a look at source number 3, passage out of the Talmud. Tanu Rabbanan, Hakol Chayavin Barba Kosos Halalu, Echad Anoshim Bechad Noshim Bechad Tinokos. Initial advice from the sages: everybody is required to have 4 cups of wine / grape juice. The men, the women, and the children. So the Gemara says, really? Amar Rabbi Yehuda, V'chimat Toelas Yesh L'Tinokos B'Yayin. Rabbi Yehuda says, what benefit are the kids going to get out of wine? That's not a way for them to demonstrate freedom. That's not even, you know, good for them. Ella, rather, he says, Mechalkin Len Klayos V'Egozin Be'erev Pesach. What we do is we distribute Klayot. Klayot is dried grain. They would parch the grain over heat. So it would essentially become sweeter and become like a candy for the kids. So they would give that to the kids. They would give them nuts, kedei shelo yishnu, so that they wouldn't sleep, and then they'd be able to ask questions. You get the kids a sugar high. That's what they're doing, in order that the kids should be awake to ask questions. The most important thing in some ways that you can do for your Seder is actually beforehand, to make sure that the kids are going to have some way to enjoy themselves so that they'll stay active and they'll stay interested at the Seder. The Gemara continues there, I didn't bring you the entire piece, to say that that's what Rabbi Akiva would do. Rabbi Akiva made sure on Erev Pesach to distribute candy to the kids for them to have for the Seder. So that's number one. More than that, I saw somebody gesture before regarding dipping, right? The practice of dipping twice, the whole idea of having karpas. There are all sorts of beautiful divrei Torah about karpas. But the origin of karpas is simply to dip something so that your kids will ask, what are you dipping? Why are you dipping this? We have 2 dippings, that one, and then we have the maror. But take a look, please, at source number 5. I'm going to come back to number 4. The Gemara in Pesachim says, "Ba'inan trei tibuli." We require 2 dippings. Ki hechi delei hevi behi keiro latinogos, so that things will be recognizably different for the children. Which, by the way, you might want to consider when you think about what you want to dip for karpas. The only firm rule that we have for what you dip is that it should be a borei pri ha'adama, something that you make this blessing on things that grow from the ground. That's the only rule. As far as what it can be, the Gemara says by preference it should be something that isn't eligible for maror. But that's it. The reason why it should be something that grows from the ground is because you want that bracha to count for your maror later on, because there's some doubt as to whether you can make a bracha of Brit Adama on maror. So therefore you make your bracha on the karpas and it'll count for the maror as well. So what do people normally use for karpas? Parsley. Sorry?
Potatoes.
Celery. I have a question, okay? And there's one person here who could answer this question better than anybody else. So I'm not going to put you on the spot, but if you want to answer it, good. If not, everybody else will answer it for you. How likely were you, as somebody who was 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, 14, whatever, how likely would you have been to be intrigued by somebody dipping potatoes or celery in salt water? Would that have caught your interest? Not really. I mean, I'm sorry. That's kind of boring. That's not going to catch your eye. So I'll tell you what we do in my family. I'm not encouraging anybody to change their menhagim. I'm just planting an idea. We use something different. We use bananas and pineapple. Why? Because it's a borei pri ha'adamah. That is the bracha you make. Even though there are banana trees and pineapple trees, nonetheless, we treat them as annuals because of the dying back of the branch that they're growing on. So the bracha is, in fact, borei pri adama. Number two, dipping pineapple in salt water is actually really good. It would have gone well with Rav Gad's Dvar Torah yesterday. Or no, it was actually Dvar Rothman, sorry. It was Dvar Rothman's Dvar Torah yesterday about the salt on the flour. The salt on the pineapple brings out its sweetness. And that is a lot more interesting, I think, than potatoes and parsley. I think you see that at your table. It grabs your attention, and the added bonus is once you've done that at your Seder, you will never ever forget that the bracha on these things is borei pri ha'adama. So, worth thinking about. But that's the karpas. The karpas is intended to inspire questions. What else is intended to inspire questions at our Seder? There's much more. Sorry? Leaning is demonstration of royalty. It does inspire questions, but I think that, as I understand it, the main goal of leaning really is the demonstration that I left Egypt. Yes? Good. Taking the Seder plate off the table. If you take a look at source number three, number four, from the Shulchan Aruch. Vaz Yitzavela Hasira Me'al Shulchan, the leader at one point instructs them to remove the matzah from the table, Anicha Besofa Shulchan, to put it at the end of the table, Kilu Kvar Achlu, as though they had already eaten. It looks like we're taking the food off the table. That the kids will see and ask. And then, Mosgin lo miyad kos sheni, we pour the second cup right away. That the kids see and ask, why are you drinking a second cup of wine? One cup of wine before eating, I know. We do that for Kiddush all the time. Why are you having a second cup of wine before you've even had your meal? There are a variety of practices. Washing for karpas. The fact that we wash for karpas, there are various suggestions as to why we wash before karpas. One of them, as I brought on the sheet in source number 6, Rabbi Chil Michal Epstein, writing in Novarduk in Lithuania at the beginning of the 20th century, said that we wash for karpas because we want to inspire questions. And then, of course, the all-time favorite, maybe even more than the candy, for kids at the Seder, what is it? What do kids most anticipate about the Seder? The Afikomen. Right? That's actually a Gemara. The Afikoman was not made up by some mischievous uncle at the Seder. Take a look at source number 7. Rabbi Eliezer says, Chot fin matzos belele psachim b'shvil tinokos shelo yishnu. We grab the matzah on the night of Pesach so that the kids will not sleep. Incidentally, you could actually help me resolve a running debate in my family. How many people here have the kids steal the Afikoman and then the parents look for it?
No, we hide it, and the kids look for it.
I'm going to lose this debate. Sorry? So you model it instead?
No, I hide it, and they look
for it. Right. So I'm in the minority here. But in my family, that was the way we did it. The kids stole it, hid it, and then the parents had to look for it at Safudin, and then they would have to promise us something in order to get it back, right? But apparently, like everybody else, the adults are hiding it, and the kids, I don't know. All right. In any case. Yeah.
That's the way they get it.
Okay.
How do they get it?
They take it, they steal it.
That's right, so you have to hit it first.
No, it's not, well, I mean, it's sort of hidden, like it's by my, I don't want to tell you, because my kids are going to watch the video, and then they're going to know where I'm hiding it. But yes, that's true, there is some hiding going on that level also. Okay, the point is, we do all of these things to keep the kids awake and engaged and involved, because we want them to ask questions, and if you take a look at source number 8, it is actually codified as a requirement of the Seder. Chacham bino, shalo. If one child is wise, the child asks. V'meino chacham, and if the kid's not able to ask the questions, ishto shalto, so then one spouse will ask. V'im lav hu shalo atzmo, and if not, you ask yourself the questions. Even if they're scholars sitting there, they're very learned, nonetheless, they have to ask the questions of each other. Meshulam Dov Soloveitchik has a very interesting response that he gave to the following question. There was a fellow whose kids had made aliyah. He wasn't living in Israel, but his kids were living in Israel. So he went to visit them for Pesach. They didn't need to have a second Seder. But he was going to have a second Seder, following the practice that many have, that even when they visit in Israel, they're going to have two Sedarim. So the question that was put to Rabbi Meshulam Dov Soloveitchik was, is there any obligation for the kids to somehow participate in their father's Seder? And his answer was, the kids have to participate to ask the Manishtana. Even though it's not Seder night for them, nonetheless, the questions are necessary, and therefore they have to participate in order to ask the questions. So why is questioning at the Seder so important? Simple formulation takes us back to what we said in the beginning about curiosity. The questions are important because they help us learn, because they keep us engaged and involved. That's the simple explanation. As a matter of fact, if you look at source number 9, the Gemara in Psachim says, Amar Shmuel Lechem Oni, the Torah calls matzah Lechem Oni, which we literally translate as bread of affliction or bread of oppression. But he says, we can also make a play on words, Lechem She'onim Alav Devarim Harbe, bread upon which we answer many things, or declare many things would be an alternative translation, but the idea is highlighting the question and answer that goes on. So that's the simple answer. We already saw, back on the first side, there are four different times where the Torah describes this discussion with our children. Encourage questions so that you will have this discussion with your children. However, there's more to it. First of all, questioning is good pedagogy. It's a good way to teach with the question and answer format. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Tzvi Elimelech Shapira of Dinov, in his Derech Pekudecha, he's better known for another work of his called B'nei Yisaschar, which is a quasi-Kabbalistic, mystical work on Chumash. So he writes, Hadavar sheba yidei she'ela, ba ha'inyan barov ha'advarim mesudar umatok lechech, v'nikba biyoter benefesh. He says, that which comes via questions can convey many ideas in an orderly way, in a sweet way, in a way that will be better absorbed and established in a person's soul. If you ask a question and get an answer, you learn much better, as opposed to somebody just presenting information. He says, you see, when authors want to deal with some very broad subject, they are worried that people aren't going to really grasp what they're saying. Because of people's own limitations, because of the depth and length and breadth of the subject. So what do people do when they want to write about such a thing? So what they do is they compose their text in the form of question and answer. Right? We've seen that within Jewish history, within our books. The Kuzari is the most obvious example that comes to mind. It exists in Greek culture, but other societies also, this idea of the question and answer format. And that's the most basic way to understand what we're doing at the Seder. Question and answer is a good way to learn. And if you take a look at source number 11, the Dubna Magid wrote, Kemoshalo Yerav Achila below Ravona Kodmo, just like food will not be sweet unless there is hunger first, so an answer will not be sweet unless it follows a great question. People like answers more when they've asked a question that led to it. So that's a simple explanation for the structure of the Haggadah. But I want to suggest two more approaches, which they're both original with me and therefore potentially both wrong, but nonetheless, I think that I think what they convey is important, and that's why I'm going to spend the next couple of minutes on them. The second idea is based on a Gemara in Nedarim. The Gemara in Nedarim Lamed Beis, I was going to bring it on here, but I wanted to fit everything into one sheet. But it's Nedarim 32a for those who want to look it up. Asks a question. Why was Avraham punished by having his descendants go down to Egypt? That's the Gemara's question. So right off the bat, I want to answer that question with a question and say, who said it had anything to do with Abraham at all? Right? We go down to Egypt because, I don't know, the brothers sold Yosef. We go down to Egypt for all sorts of reasons. What are you pinning it on Abraham for? What does it say, though?
It says 400 years you will be slaves.
Yeah, no, Yadoa te dakigir yezaracha beretz lalahem. Know that your children are going to be slaves, or they're going to be strangers in a land not their own, but they will be made to work, be new of some, and they will be oppressed for 400 years. Yes?
Why do we consider this a punishment to Abraham? A Kodesh Baruch Hu is informing him. I'm telling you that this is what's going to happen. I'm giving you the ability of Nevuah. So here, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to set your children down. It's not a punishment to you. I'm just letting you know.
Exactly. Hang on, wait. You're on the next phase. Hold that phase, okay? The first thing is, how do I know that this is a punishment for Avram at all? Maybe it's just information, to which my answer is because Avram doesn't need to know it. Avram doesn't need to know this. Imagine, God forbid, I don't want to say about any of us, but imagine some hypothetical person, right, whose child, after he's gone from this world, is going to go do something terrible, or is going to experience something horrible. He can't do a thing about it. He cannot prevent it. He cannot give any advice for handling it. There's nothing he can do. Why in the world would you want to tell him about that? Why give him that information? And so, one way to read that Gemara is that it's not about why we had to go down. There are all sorts of reasons why we had to go down. But why does Avraham need to know it? And the Gemara asks, Gemara gives multiple answers, but one of those answers is the one that this table has been ready to provide. It's the verse I referenced in source number 12, but I didn't bring you the whole verse there in the interest of preserving space, but you can look it up. Avraham is told by Hashem, you're going to have this land. You will have children, and the children will get this land. And Avraham's response is, Bama eida ki irashena, how do I know that I'm going to get it? Which is a startling question for the hero of Lech Lecha.
He has no heirs.
Sorry?
He has no heirs. He has no children.
Right. Right. But when he was told, go to this land that I'm going to show you, he went. Right? When he's told, sacrifice his son, he did it. Avraham is in the habit of accepting. This question is really startling, and the Gemara is bothered by it, and all the commentators try to provide different explanations for what Avraham was really thinking when he asked the question, but the Gemara takes it at face value, and says, this is Shmuel speaking in the Gemara, he says, that's why Avraham is told this. It's a punishment for that doubt. You were going to say?
I was going to say that when Avraham went in Lech Lecha, Hashem didn't promise him anything at that point in time. He just told him, I want you to go to this land that I'm going to show you.
The next sentence he promises you. He says, "Ve'es chalagoy gadol, I'm going to make you a great nation." Yeah, listen to your son. The Vavarecha, Vagadlo Shemecha, I'll give you a great name. Yeah, he does promise. So that's one question which ties into our descent to Egypt. Then Hashem tells Moshe, I'm going to send you to take the Jews out of Egypt, and Moshe has nothing but questions. Couldn't you send somebody else? I don't know how to speak properly. The Jews are going to ask me, what's your name? The Jews aren't going to believe me. Right? I mean, I gave you a list there in source number 13. All but the last one are those questions from that initial conversation with Hashem about going to save the Jews. Moshe, go rescue the Jews. I'm God. I'm going to take them out. Really? How does that response is really difficult. So much so that the Torah says that Hashem got angry at him. And Hashem punished him for it. As one Medrash explains, Moshe was supposed to be not only Moshe, but also Kohen Gadol. He was supposed to be Aaron as well, so to speak. And Hashem took it away from him. Because of the question, the last one I brought you in source number 13 is after Moshe goes to Paro. And Paro responds by making things worse, right? He says, we're not going to give you any straw to make the bricks. And Moshe goes back to God and he says, see, I went to Paro and all that's happened is things have become worse. Why did you bother sending me in the first place? Yeah. But the point is that Moshe also has questions, and they're not positive questions. They're questions of skepticism. Just like Avram's question was one of skepticism. And then the Jews, of course, have questions of skepticism, right? They get out of Egypt, they go to the sea, and they turn around and say, what's the matter? We don't have enough graves in Egypt? We didn't have graves there. You had to take us out to die in the wilderness. And I brought you in source 14 various questions they ask. They get thirsty. They ask why you did this. They get hungry. They ask God, why'd you do this? And so maybe what we're doing at our Seder, when we reenact leaving Egypt, is that we reenact asking questions as well. But our questions are the more positive kind. Instead of questions of skepticism, they're questions to learn. They're questions of loyalty. I brought you the Rambam in source number 15, when he says, in every generation, one must act as though he left Egypt, Laharos as Atzmo. One has to act as though he personally had left the slavery of Egypt. It's about asking questions to reenact that aspect of leaving Egypt, but with a positive spin of using the questions to build our faith. And then the third and last, the question as interrogation or interrogative. You know, when we use the word interrogate for question, it's actually a very important word. It comes from the Latin, interrogare. Inter means... within or between, right? Rogare is ask. It's to ask between. That there is a person here, and there is a person there, and there is something going on between them. The question is a robust way to connect generations. Sometimes we ask questions out of pure curiosity. And sometimes it's out of skepticism, but sometimes it's out of a desire to connect. If you take a look at source number 16, I could have brought you any number of websites for this. I found this one that expressed it concisely, so I chose this one. Advice for telemarketers. Right, you didn't know they needed that. But there's advice for success in telemarketing. The best technique in sales leads telemarketing, start a conversation. And the advice goes, start a conversation. Does not have to be a long one or anything. It just has to be easy and social enough to compel your audience to listen to what you say. And mind you, you are not telling them all the details yet. You just aim to get a reaction from them at the start. So they give you, after that, like a sample conversation, but all of us have had them, so you don't really need the sample conversation. But when they ask you something like, how is the weather, or how is your day, it's not because they care. They're asking you the question just to set up a pattern of ask a question, get a response. Ask a question, get a response. They're setting up a connection. They're setting up a relationship. They may also care. They're human beings also. They may care. But that's not the part of their job that's going into this. The question is interrogation. It's a way to connect people. And in fact, that's the history of questions in the Torah. Where is the very first question in the Torah? Hashem asking Adam, where are you, is the second question in the Torah.
Asking the angels how should make the man.
Oh, asking whether to make man. Well, that's true. The Medrash says that when Hashem says, Naaseh Adam, let us make man, that there was a question first. But I'm looking for a question that's actually expressed explicitly in a pasuk, in a verse. Yeah, bingo. The Nachash, the snake. The snake, v'anachash haya arum, mikol chayat ha-sadeh. The snake was more clever than all of the beasts of the field. V'yomer el ha'isha, and he said to the woman, af ki amar Elokim lo sochlu mikol eitz hagan? Is it true that God said not to eat from any of the trees in the garden? That's the first question. Is it a real question? No. How do you know it's not a real question? Because it's not true, and he knows it's not true. Either he wasn't there, in which case he wouldn't know about the command at all, or he was there, in which case he would know. The command was, don't eat from this tree. Hashem said explicitly, every tree in the garden is yours, except for this one. What Adam told Chava is irrelevant. This is the snake talking. The snake knows. And by the way, Chava was part of Adam at that point, so what she knew or didn't know is actually a great machlokas. But the snake knows full well what it was. He's identified with the Yetzer Hara. Correct. But the snake knows, and And so Rashi writes on that pasuk, which I referred you to in source number 17. That's Perek Gimel Pasuk Aleph, chapter 3, sentence 1. Rashi says, what is the snake doing? He wants to start a conversation with Chava. That's what he wants. He wants to get into a conversation. And so he asks her a question that he knows is wrong, just for the sake of getting into the conversation. Then he hits pay dirt when she gives him the wrong answer, when she says, oh, we can't touch it either. But that's the first question. And then the second question is the one that was mentioned. After they've eaten from the fruit, and they're hiding from God, then Hashem calls out and says, Ayeka, where are you? Well, God doesn't know. He made those trees, you know. He made Adam. He knows exactly where Adam is. And so, once again, Rashi comments on that sentence, and he says, Hashem is starting a conversation. It's about building a connection. Asking a question of the previous generation at the Seder is a way to recognize ourselves as part of them, to build a connection. We are supposed to be the timeless Jewish nation, greater than the sand. That's what we are. But it only works that way if the next generation sees itself as linked to the previous one. And so we need to make sure that our children are going to ask questions in order to build that bond. And to my mind, then, there are three reasons for all these things that we do at the Seder, which we listed. Reason number one, it's a good way to teach. Reason number two is we're trying to reenact the questions that were associated with going to Egypt and leaving Egypt initially, but to do it in a positive way instead of the skepticism that was there originally. And then the third, as a means of connecting people, connecting the generations, wanting the kids to ask the questions as opposed to them just hearing a story told. Last point, source number 18 is just a YouTube link, as you see. It's a video called either What Is That? Or The Sparrow. How many people here have seen that? Yes, that's the one. So Neil has seen it. You see it. It is my absolute all-time favorite. I watch it at least once a year, if not more. It's a scene with a father and a son. And I have a hard time describing this. Actually, I spoke about this video once in a different setting. I started crying as I'm describing it, so I apologize in advance. But it's absolutely beautiful, and it's a must-see. It's Greek, I think, but there are subtitles, so it's no problem. But it's a short video, a couple of minutes, and it's a father and a son who are sitting on a bench outside a house, and the son's reading the newspaper, and the father is sitting next to him, and the father is clearly somebody's probably 70s, 80s, and the son is whatever it is, 40s, and the father sees a bird land on a bush. And he says to his son, what is that? And the son says, oh, it's a sparrow. And a minute goes by, and the bird shifts in some way, flies down to the ground, and the father asks again, what is that? And the son says, I told you already, it's a sparrow. And then it shifts a third time, and the father says, what is that? And the son loses it. He says, "Yeah, it's in Greek, so that's something like sporeti for a sparrow." So he like breaks down the syllable sporeti. I told you already, it's a sparrow. And the father gets up to go into the house, and the son is like, "Where are you going?" Waves his hand at him. Father goes into the house, comes back with a book, and it's a diary, and he gives it to his son. And he says, read. And the son starts reading. He says, no, out loud. And the son starts reading out loud. And it's the father's diary from a day when his child was 3 years old. And he describes, my son, who is 3 years old, was at the park with me today. And he asked me 21 times, what is that? There was a bird that flew in. And he asked me 21 times, what is that bird? And each time I told him it was a sparrow, and each time I hugged him and I kissed him, and obviously the message is clear. But it's a beautiful video, and I'm not doing it justice by telling it. You have to see it. But the point is, that's the idea of the question as connection. What the son didn't understand in this video is that when he asks, what is this about the sparrow, he's not asking, you know, for information. It's about a connection. And so hopefully this year when we have our Seder and we are all sitting around together and these questions are asked, they will serve as a means of education. They will serve as a means of reliving those initial questions, but in a stronger faith-producing way, and they will serve as building those connections within our family to create stronger families and a stronger Jewish people. Thank you.